This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
They retraced their steps, seven stations back again, and they get frustrated. They start getting angry, and they start complaining. Interestingly enough, what they complain about is not the fact that they have to retrace their steps. What they complain about is the food. They find other things to complain about. Rashi explains there that complaining is something which takes place when the mind is not sufficiently stretched counters hardship and is unable to integrate those hardships, then one comes up to the surface, one feels aggravated, one feels unhappy, and one begins to complain. It's an element of harchovas da'at, says Rashi. The wider the mind, the more occupied the mind, the more active the mind, the more feasible is it to be able to absorb and integrate the hardships and to slowly digest them, and one gets through them. Not so if one's encountering difficulties at a time when one's mind isn't able, and that's why Rashi says the term kritzer ruach is used. Kritzer ruach means short-spirited. Short-spirited or short-minded, where the soul, where the spirit, where the intellect is just not sufficiently expanded to be able to take in its stride the various hardships that one encounters inevitably as one goes through life. And when one's mind is not sufficiently broad to be able to encounter these hardships and tolerate them and take them in one's stride, then one complains about anything and everything. Everything becomes a problem and everything becomes a difficulty. So they complain about the mon. Can you imagine anything that should give less right to complaint than the mon? The Ribbono Shel'olam creates for them a food designed to be as little, to cause as little trouble to them as possible. As little as possible. It doesn't need preparation, it doesn't need cooking, you don't have to work for it. It's there every morning, it's ready made. It can be made to taste whatever you want it to taste. And if you have different people around the table with different tastes, it doesn't matter. Each one can taste what they want to taste. There's absolutely no difficulty. One could imagine, especially the women, I'm sure, no more idyllic situation than having mon to be able to feed the family on. Every day. So the men don't have to worry because they don't have to go to work. And the women don't have to worry because they don't have to cook. And it's just absolutely wonderful. So one would think of all the hardships in the desert, if one were to ask, not knowing this parasha of Chumash, if I were to say to you, of all the hardships in the desert, what would you think Am Yisrael are least likely to complain about? There's no question one would say the mon. The mon they're least likely to complain. That's one thing they've got no reason to gripe about. Everything else, oh, this they've got problems with, this they've got difficulties with, I can understand. But the mon, it's a gift from the Ribbono Shel Olam. It's an idyllic situation. There can be nothing better than that. Comes in the parasha and the mon's no good also. Nothing's any good. Everything's a problem. Everything's difficult. When one is in a gripey mood, everything is a gripe. Nothing can go right. No matter how idyllic it is, one can be in Gan Eden, and one will find something wrong about Gan Eden. I wasn't sitting at the top table, or I was sitting at the top table, or I wasn't. Oh, there will be something to complain about. If one is in a complaining mode, complaints and bitterness and unhappiness is a function of one's own state of mind. It's not always caused by the hardship. As we discussed last week and again in the ladies' shiur this morning, hardship we face with continuously. There are always difficulties. There are always hardships. Some people grow from them and some people become embittered as a result of them. And that depends not on the severity of the hardships, that depends on the capacity of the human being to absorb his hardships and cope with them. His coping mechanism will determine whether he is in a complaining mode or whether he is in a happy mode. And if he's in a happy mode, every problem is a challenge. And if he's in a complaining mode, every challenge is a problem. It's two ways of looking at the same thing. It's either a challenge or a problem, and that depends on the individual. And that's particularly so since we live in a world of imperfection. In Olam HaEmes, there's nothing to complain about. The only thing to complain about in Olam HaEmes is oneself. That's the only inadequate thing in Olam HaEmes, is oneself. But in this world, this you can find something to complain about everything, because there is nothing in the world which is perfect. There is nothing in the world about which you cannot find an imperfection and something missing and something distorted and something which shouldn't be there. There is nothing and there is nobody about whom one can't find that. So if one is in a complaining mode, one will not experience difficulty in finding what to complain about. And so they complain about the mon. But one needs to understand their complaint about the mon in its correct perspective. After all, these were very great people. These weren't some faribulniks. These were the Dorodeo. These were the generation of the greatest minds. This was the generation of the Mekabli Torah. These were very, very big people. And big people's complaints are different to small people's complaints. As I said on Wednesday night, if people's complaints at least develop and grow as time goes on, then at least one feels that something's growing. But maybe they're not growing, but at least the faribles are getting bigger. But when the faribles stay the same year after year, then it's done, that they're not getting bigger and the faribles aren't getting bigger. Nothing's changing. That's total stagnation. When one looks at the complaints of big people, one has to understand that they're big complaints. So when we're talking about the dirt, they are complaining about the mon, we're not talking about some little gripe. We're talking about a major issue in Ruchnius. They were only concerned with their spiritual welfare. They weren't concerned with the taste of the food or with the context or with the texture of the food. They were concerned with more important things. And yet even the taste of the food is important. Even the material things are important. There's a medrash in Emor, in Simon Tafresh Nun Dalad in the Yalkut, that says, Atom Moitse Sholish Samochis. There are three types of simcha, or three times when simcha is mentioned in relationship to Yom Tov. B'chag, in the case of Sukkot, it says, B'somachta b'chagecha, once, you shall be happy on Sukkot. B'hoyiso ach sameach, you shall be only happy. U'samachtem lifnei Hashem elokeichim shivas yomim. And you shall be happy before the Ribbono Shel Olam for 7 days. What kind of simcha? The pashtus, simcha shel mitzvah, one sitting in the sukkah, and one's emunah, and bitochen, and closeness to the Ribbono Shel Olam, and sholish regolim, and so on and so forth. That's what it means by pashtus, but we see not so. However, about the Pesach, ein ata moitzei shekosuv ba'afilu simcha achas. That in the parasha that deals with Pesach, the word simcha isn't mentioned once. Now that's very peculiar. If the simcha is because of Yom Tov and because one's sitting with the Ribbono Shel Olam all the time and one's dedicated for 7 days to the Chag and to everything that goes with it, then there should be no difference between Pesach and Sukkot. Just as one has simcha on Sukkot, one should have simcha on Pesach. So why then in Pesach is there no mention of simcha? Atamitzah says the Medrash of Pesach hatavu anidonis. On Pesach, produce is being judged. Ve'ein ato yodea im oise hashono tvua im eina oise. And you don't know yet at Pesach time whether you're going to have any produce or not. It's the spring, it's the beginning of the season, and you don't know your business results. It's nowhere near the end of your financial year, and you don't know how things are going to turn out. Therefore, there can't be yet simcha. Ulefichach ein kosuv sham simcha. And because of that material uncertainty, the Ribbono Shel Olam does not expect simcha from us on Pesach. Amazing concept. Because of material uncertainty, we, the Bnei Yisrael, Talmidei Chachomim, attached to Torah, can't we detach ourselves from our material world and find simcha in the spiritual world in which we operate? So we don't know if it will be a good year or not materially. Who cares? The fact is we're learning well and everything's wonderful and fine. Isn't that enough? No, says the Medrash, that's not enough. The Ribbono Shel Olam expects us to derive simcha not only from the spiritual things in life. He expects us to find simcha in the material things of life too. He expects us to find simcha in the physical things of life too. V'chein atal moitze she'in kosuv ba'atzeret ala simcha achas. And so by Shavuos you'll find simcha is mentioned once. V'lama kosuv bo simcha achas is the Medrash. Why does it say simcha once in the case of Shavuos? Because the produce is brought into the silos at Shavuos time. Good. So then write it twice.
If the produce is in already, then there should be two simchas for Shavuos.
Now says the Medrash, the fish peiros ha'ilon nidoinim, because the fruit of the trees are not yet in. You've only got half of your results. You know that there's good produce, but you don't yet know the orchards haven't produced their results yet. Only some of your companies have brought their results in, but the final, the holding company's results aren't in yet. You don't know. There might be losses in other companies. Who cares about the materials after the Shavuos? It's Chag Moson Toraseinu. Surely all we've got to worry about is our Torah, and we should have Simcha in our Torah. Who cares what's about financial results? No, this is the Medrash. But Ribbono Shel Olam doesn't expect us to be able to give him the type of Simcha he desires from us if we aren't able to have that Simcha in all areas, including the material. That's part of the bracha that has to be. And we have a terrible tendency, but maybe it's a good tendency in a way, of making a lechatchila out of a bidiyevet. Lechatchila means the way things are supposed to be, and bidiyevet means the way they turned out. We have a way of, when something's bidiyevet, it's turned out that way. It's not ideal, but that's the way it turned out. We have a way of persuading ourselves that that's really lechatchila how it's meant to be. So if you miss your bus or you miss your plane, you have a way of convincing yourself that you were really meant to miss your plane. That's the way it was supposed to be. That wasn't the way it was supposed to be. You were meant to catch it. You missed it because you were careless. So it is with many things that happen. And because we're used to the Golas, for so many years we haven't had Brocha, for so many years we've had a struggle and battle, and materialism hasn't gone hand in hand with Torah, we start convincing ourselves that that's really how the Ribbono Shel Olam wants it. He wants materialism to be in the hands of the Goyim, and to be in the hands of the non-religious. They must be wealthy, and we poor Yidden must be Mishulochim, and we must be poor, and we must have a miserable time, and we must be cold in the winter and hungry in the summer. That's how the Ribbono Shel Olam wants it, because that's the price for Torah. Nonsense! That's not the way the Ribbono Shel Olam wants it. That's the way we've made it, by our actions over the thousands of years in which we've lived. That's not the way the Ribbono Shel Olam wants it. He wants Brocha. He wants Simcha. What kind of Brocha? What kind of Simcha? Look at the Brochas in the Torah. When it lists the Brochas, what does it say? Brochas in Ruchnius? No. The Ruchnius, you're responsible for yourself. You'll grow as much as you put effort in. Where we need Brocha from the Ribbono Shel Olam is in Gashmir. In material things, that's where we need Brocha, and that's where the Ribbono Shel Olam promises us Brocha, if we live correctly. So the Ribbono Shel Olam wants us to enjoy the physical things in life too. As the Rav Notitz Finkel puts it, Boro HaKadosh Baruch Hu et Ha'odom loy l'shem ta'anugim ruchniim bilvad. The Ribbono Shel Olam created man not for spiritual pleasure only. Ki im gam l'shem ta'anugim gashmi. I'm afraid that if Rav Notitz Finkel would say this today, he would be, I don't know what, he would be put in some kind of cherem and not be allowed to speak publicly in any yeshiva. Listen to what he says. The Ribbono Shel Olam created man not only for spiritual pleasure, but for material pleasure too. That's part of the purpose of creation. V'loy rak mishum zeh shim yechasru lo ha'tanugim agashmim yufru gam tanugav haruchnim. And it is not because without physical pleasures you might not be able to achieve spiritual pleasures. It's not the physical only as a means to the spiritual. Ela mishum shakodesh baruch hu roitze b'hanos ha'odom hashlimo. That because the Ribbono Shel Olam wants the human being to enjoy himself, to be happy and fulfilled in perfection, in completion, in entirety. V'simchosei hashlimo shitichlo leskol rikshoyso v'chusho. And he wants the human being to be happy in a way which includes all his emotions and senses. He wants us to be fulfilled with every one of our senses. To be totally happy and totally fulfilled. L'loy kol shiur, with nothing left out. That's what the Ribbono Shel Olam wants of us. So the author from Slavotka talking. The Baal Musa talking. The Ribbono Shel Olam wants us to be fulfilled and happy not only in spiritual ways, but also in material ways, also in gashmistic ways too. Of course, it has to be the right kind of fulfillment and the right kind of happiness, and directed in the right direction. But that's meant to be. There's never been a precept of Yiddishkeit to deny ourselves. We don't have it. Good little fellows, we don't have it. We don't overemphasize it. But not to see it as brocha, not to see it as the Ratzoyin Hashem, to be able to look at a beautiful view and take it in and derive pleasure from it. Not just ruchniyus dika pleasure
oh, through this I can see the greatness of the Ribbono Shel Olam, and then make a whole musa shmuz out of it. You don't have to moralize everything. There's such a thing as direct aesthetic pleasure. Just look at it and say, ah, geshmak, isn't this beautiful? Lovely. And to look at a flower or to smell a flower, to taste good food and to appreciate the good food, to look at a work of art and just say, this is magnificent, this is lovely. And then somebody will come and say, what do you learn? What can you learn? It's magnificent, it's beautiful. I'm elevating myself. Harchovas hadas, as we mentioned earlier, it's part of my mind stretching practice. It broadens me, it makes me able to tolerate the hardships of life a little more. When one has been elevated, when one has been broadened, when one's looked a little further afield and one's seen beautiful things, one can take the little knock so much more easily. But when one starts isolating oneself from that, and one doesn't look, and one doesn't see, and one doesn't appreciate, and one's only source of appreciation is in a pure, very fine spiritual area, we're not angels. And then when we take a knock in an area slightly outside our spiritual areas, we can't tolerate it. We become embittered, and we become distorted, and we become twisted, and we become negative, and we become critical. Why? Because we're so narrow. We're just not exposed to enough richness to enable ourselves to feel that it just doesn't matter. I was talking to a particular Rav and Rosh Yeshiva that I met in Eretz Yisrael, very, very, very fine and special person. Not a conventional person at all. We were commenting about a few things about him. Number one, he doesn't miss a symphony concert. Doesn't miss a symphony concert. Unless there's something very serious. He's a person, by the way, who is shut inside out. You've shown me hand about all the posting. And the person sleeps 2 or 3 hours a night. Nothing else to do. The person is a masmid, is a Talmud Chochem of the highest caliber, involved in many projects, involved in many educational institutions in Eretz Yisrael, but he finds time for that as well. So I commented to that part, find the conversation fairly quickly. Later on, I commented on the fact that he wasn't involved in some kind of political issue that was going on at the time, and I thought it was the kind of area that he would become involved in. He says, you don't understand. Those people are involved in it because they need entertainment, they need outlet. I get my entertainment at the symphony concerts. I don't need to get involved in that narishkeit. It's not important for me. I've got my source of entertainment. And it was said only half in jest. A person who has things, he appreciates them, he enjoys them, he's a meal and he's able to say, wonderful, nice, delicious, without feeling guilty. Oy, I'm enjoying Gashmir, there must be something wrong with me. Without feeling that. He's able to expose himself to beauty and to pleasure and to acknowledge and accept that pleasure in gratitude and in fulfillment. Such a person is able to take a whole lot of things that the narrow person can't tolerate because he doesn't have a wide enough base to be able to tolerate it. And this is the wonderful thing that in religious life one has to be so careful about, that one doesn't allow oneself to become so narrow that one loses one's stability in total. That's what the Alter von Slavotka says. And therefore we begin to understand the concern of Klal Yisrael at living on the Mon for 40 years. They have not had the opportunity of enjoying a good meal for 40 years. Of complimenting the cook. Of saying, this is a fine apple, or this is a really good steak, a really good piece of meat, or what a delicious cake. They can't really say that because it's all the same Mon in different guises, and who's the Bein Shalom's the baker? There's no, they haven't really had the opportunity of enjoying that special delight which the Rebbein Shalom has given the human being the capacity to find in the food that he eats. That's a pleasure which the Rebbein Shalom has supplied the human being with. And you remember when we learned a Tosfos in Brochus about the Brocha Achrono, where the Tosfos makes clear that the Borei Nefoshes Rabbis Chesreino Nakom Asher Boroso is a Brocha made
for those foods which are not essential, primarily. It's a bracha that refers, or certainly refers in part, to those foods which are not essentials. The apples and the oranges and all the things like that. And we asked, so why? If they're not essential, why did the Ribbono Shel Olam create them? To give us the pleasure of variety. Different foods that look different, that taste different, that are different. Because that's a pleasure that the Ribbono Shel Olam wants us to have. That's one of the many pleasures that the Ribbono Shel Olam wants us to have. Why? Because a healthy human being needs to be happy. And he needs to be happy in all areas. And if he's happy in all areas, he can tolerate. He doesn't need entertainment. And if he gets a knock here and there, it doesn't matter, because his happiness is so much more overwhelming than the disadvantages that he's able to cope with the disadvantages and take them in his stride. That's what the Ribbono Shel Olam wants, and that's what Klal Yisrael wanted. One can take it further. One can say that not only that did they want, but they also wanted a very special spiritual benefit from their involvement in the physical. This is also a concept of Reb Nachum Tzvi Finkel. Torah, as learnt, studied and practiced by human beings, as opposed to the angels, is unique in that what it occupies us with is not merely an involvement in the concepts, but what it occupies us with is the conceptualization of material things. The concepts the angels have got as well. And when the angels objected to the Torah being given to the Ribbono Shel Olam, you will remember, the Ribbono Shel Olam said to the angels, it says, do you have a mother and father? How can you observe the Torah? The Torah doesn't apply to you. The Torah applies to human beings. It talks about what animals you can eat and what animals you can't eat, and how to slaughter them and how not to slaughter them. What's that got to do with you, angels? So the angels could have answered very simply. The angels could have answered, but Torah is for the concepts, for the ideas. We don't have to put it into practice. One can sit and learn it. The learning itself is an end in itself. And so it is. But the Ribbono Shel Olam says that's not enough. The importance of Torah is to conceptualize, to take the physical things and make of them concepts in Torah. That's the ultimate level that we have, which the Siddur Shorim speaks in the later chapters, the ability to elevate the material, the ability to elevate the physical and the material into spiritual concepts. For example, we talk about our tables as mizbeches. To be able to relate to the table as a mizbeach, that's part of the avodah of being a human being. That's part of the service of being a human being. To see the table as an altar, that's the avodah. Not just to know. We split ourselves. We sit at the table and we treat it like a table. Then it's time for a Dvar Torah. So we say about how the Torah is compared to an altar. We give a nice little Dvar Torah, and that's why we put salt on the bread, because the bread is compared to a sacrifice, and on sacrifices there have to be salt. Then we close our Dvar Torah and we carry on treating the table like a table. We don't put the two together at all. If the table is a mizbeach, how one has to draw close to the table, how one has to sit down at the table, how one has to eat at the table, what kind of conversation there has to be at the table, how one has to treat one's food. And the whole avodah changes, then eating becomes an avodah, then eating becomes a service of God. And that's the true challenge of living in a material world according to Torah precepts. It's not living two lives, living the material and living the spiritual. But it's a matter of infusing the material with the spiritual and elevating, making of it concepts of Torah. To take the wine of Kiddush and to make Kiddush on the wine, to turn what used to be wine, to turn that into Yayin, a halachic concept called Yayin, that with which we use for Nesachim on the Mizbeach, that which we use for wine offerings on the Mizbeach, that's a concept in Kodshim, it's a concept in Halacha, and when we're holding our glass of wine, it is also, apart from the material pleasure which we spoke about first, there is the additional conceptual, intellectual pleasure of seeing the physical in terms of the spiritual, in terms of the conceptual. To take these material things and elevate them into supreme ideas and concepts, and to live in the two worlds simultaneously. That's the second level of involvement in this material world in which we operate. And there too, Klal Yisrael felt that they wanted some real food to be able to elevate. To have to handle such a spiritual existence, and it wasn't only the moon, that everything they did was such a spiritual existence, where they didn't need to elevate anything because it was already elevated. Everything was spiritual to start with. The food came directly from the Ribbono Shel Olam. There was nothing to elevate there. They felt they wanted the challenge of fulfilling the Avodas Hashem as we do today, of taking something material and making it spiritual, elevating it, lifting it up, and making it special. And they did not have the opportunity to do that with the Mon. That's the way the Alter von Slavotke learns that this parsha, this complaining about the Mon, that it didn't offer them that opportunity. Now that's very nice. The problem with that is, why does the Ribbono Shel Olam get angry? That's like a very nice complaint. If that's what the complaint is about, that's a very nice complaint. Why does the Ribbono Shel Olam get angry with it? He gives another example. Yerovam was a king of Yisrael who launched Yisrael into decades, generations, centuries of decadence and degeneration, spiritually and morally. He started the practice of idolatry in Yisrael. And all the later kings who continued it because of his activities, as we've learned in the ladies' Tanakh Shir. So he's a man who had a lot to account for. On the other hand, Yerovam was a great Rosh Yeshiva, believe it or not. He was a great Rosh Yeshiva in whose time the other Talmidei Chachomim, the Gemara tells us in Sanhedrin Daf Kuf Beis, couldn't hold a candle to him. The other Talmidei Chachomim of the time weren't a patch on Yerovam. There was no area in Torah in which Yerovam wasn't absolutely in control and totally had it at his fingertips, absolutely and totally. Yerovam was the Talmid Chachom par excellence of his time, the greatest of all. No Rosh Yeshiva, no Rov, no Dayan could come anywhere near the stature of Yerovam ben Levat. But he led Bnei Yisrael into idolatry. That happens sometimes. Later on, after he dies, the Ribbono Shel Olam offers him an opportunity for tshuva. And says, come Yerovam, chazor b'cha, do tshuva. You're such a great man. Do tshuva. And you and me and Ben Yishai, David HaMelech, the tail began Eden. We'll walk together in Gan Eden. Can you imagine a better? Can you imagine anything like that? The Ribbono Shel Olam on his right, David HaMelech on his left, Yerovam ben Nevat, walking, spending the rest of eternity in each other's intimate company. Imagine anything more than that. Says Yerovam, Mi Barosh. Who'll be at the top? In other words, who'll be on your right hand side? The right hand side is the second most important, the center is the most important position, and the next is the right, and the third is the left. Mi Barosh, who's going to be first? David or me? Says the Ribbono Shel Olam, Ben Yishai Barosh. David is first. You'll be second. Says Yerovam, no thank you. Don't want it. So again, we learn it in a simple way, with jealousies and this and that, but Yerovam was a great man. And he's offered an opportunity by the Ribbono Shel Olam himself to do tshuva and to be so close to him. Explains the Alter von Slabodka, that's because man has an insatiable desire for intimacy with the Ribbono Shel Olam. And Yerovam could not tolerate anything but perfection. If he was not going to be right next to the Ribbono Shel Olam in number one slot, then nothing. Absolute perfectionist to the point of obsession with perfectionism, to the point where he rejects anything which is not perfect. I want to be next to you, Ribbono Shel Olam, then David HaMelech. Not because I'm jealous of David HaMelech, but if I can't be right next to you, if there's someone between you and me, I can't tolerate. In that case also, that's quite a nice title, that's very great. But Ribbono Shel Olam then rejects him. And that's his last chance, and he loses his last chance. There too we must ask, why does he get treated so harshly if the reason for his rejecting the Ribbono Shel Olam's proposition is really quite a holy reason? Just as the reason for Am Yisrael's complaint about the Mon was a holy reason, why do they get treated so harshly? Why the Magefa? They get treated with this plague in which so many people die. And we must answer in the following way. Very often, complaints express themselves in a very spiritual manifestation, as we've just seen. Sometimes you get a very physical complaint, you get a very material sort of complaint. I have a faribul. What's your faribul? Your faribul is that at your simcha, I sat at table number four, whereas so-and-so, who isn't quite as good a friend of yours as I am, sat at table number three. I have a faribul. So that's little petty nonsense, and one has to just handle that. But sometimes the faribles are much more attractive than that. Sometimes the faribles are quite colourful, and they have a certain charm. And one can't just dispel them so easily. Sometimes the feribul is, for example, what? Yes, you had an opportunity once a week to learn chavrusa, and you gave that opportunity to so and so, and you didn't offer me a chance. And I need it more than he does. I'm feribuled with you. You had an opportunity. You've got time. Good. You're able to learn an hour a week or an hour a day with somebody, and you chose him and not me. That's a different kind of faribul already. This is a spiritual faribul. It's a different story. A person comes along and says, you know, there was a job to be done in the Beis HaMedrash. Somebody else was chosen to do the job, not me. I would have liked to have done the job. Why wasn't I asked to do it? That's a different kind of faribul. That's not kovid. That's not kovid seeking. That's a person who feels he wants to give more, he wants to learn more, he wants to progress more, and he has been deprived of the opportunity. That's a very colorful faribul. That's a different story altogether. That has some shape to it, that has some depth to it. Bnei Yisrael have a faribul with the Ribbono Shel Olam. Mon, mon, mon. What's the problem? Doesn't taste good? No, it tastes fine. That's not the problem. But we are being deprived of an opportunity of certain progress in Avodas Hashem, which we cannot achieve with mon. We've done all we can do with mon, and now we want to do more. We want real food that we can make a real brocha on, and a real birkas hamazon on, that we can elevate properly, that we can treat our tables as mizbeches, and our efforts will elevate the food, not have food which is objectively elevated to start with. We want to do it. It's a different kind of a faribul. Yet, the Ribbono Shel Olam treats it very harshly. Not very impressed is the Ribbono Shel Olam with that faribul. Why not? It's true, sometimes one gets upset that one could have had an opportunity to do more and to contribute more and to progress more, and one has been denied that opportunity by, according to one's perception, somebody else's action or neglect or absence of action or whatever. What then is the proper response? The proper response is not to undermine that which you already do have. The proper response is, it's very nice what I've got, but I could have had more. There's a very great difference. If they would have come along and said, Ribbono Shel Olam, the mon which you've given us is wonderful. It saved the women so much time. And it's enabled them to also learn a little bit of Torah. And it's enabled us not to have to go out and work. If we work out what we've saved in time and in Kedusha and Taro over the 40 years of having the mon, it's absolutely wonderful. What a chesed, Ribbono Shel Olam. We cannot thank you enough for the mon. However, we feel it's time that we would like something in addition to the mon. We would like some real food too. How about that? Against that, the Ribbono Shel Olam could have had no taina. You are recognizing what you've got and you want to go further. If Yerovam would have said, Ribbono Shel Olam, to stand second place to David HaMelech, that's not my first prize. Of course, I'm very grateful for the opportunity. I've been an Oved Aved Zorah all the time. I've been an idolater, and I've introduced idolatry to Klal Yisrael. I don't deserve a chance at all. And therefore, Ribbono Shel Olam, I appreciate the fact that you've even given me a chance. But really, what I crave for is to be right next to you in position number one, and I'm prepared to do anything for that. Against that, the Ribbono Shel Olam would have had no taina. You're recognizing what you've got, and you're expressing a desire for more. In the spiritual world, that is to be praised. But where your desire for more incorporates a disparagement of what you've got, that's not a desire for more. That's complaining. That's not spiritual at all. That's the same old complaining disguised as something spiritual, disguised as something elevated. But it's not spiritual at all. If it were spiritual, one would not undermine what you have. One would acknowledge and appreciate what you've got and find ways of making it better. That's what one does if it's spiritual. So what is this terrible tendency that one has and that one finds so frequently? That there is a tendency not only to want more, but in the wanting of the more, to undermine that which there is already. It's more than just undermining that which there is already. It's undermining the source of that which is yours, that which is giving you. To undermine the mon. They're living by the mon. They've survived 40 years for the mon.
If it weren't for that, they would all be wiped out. The mon is their livelihood. To become cynical and nasty about the very source of your sustenance. How is that possible to understand? But we find that in life. That we have a tendency to destroy the very source of our goodness. It's the most tragic, perhaps the most tragic human factor that there is. The tendency to destroy the source of our goodness. For example, you will find almost inevitably that unless a child has been trained by very wonderful parents or by very wonderful education, he will go through a period in his life, probably during adolescence, but not necessarily, where he finds fault with his parents. Every child, virtually every child, goes through some stage where his parents are not quite what they should be. And he finds fault in them. And that's a problem in the child parent relationship. It's a problem that the child has to overcome. And eventually he does. What about the parent's relationship to his children? The problem there is the other way around. The parent can never find the fault with the child. Everybody else can see the faults, but not the parent. What is that? Why is it that it is inevitable that a child finds fault with his parents, and it is equally inevitable that a parent cannot find fault with his children? It should be the other way around. Who owes more gratitude to who? It's the child who should not be capable of finding fault in his parent, not the parent who can't find fault with the child. But we see there is such a tendency to find fault in that which is serving you, to find fault in that which is giving you life. There's a very harsh Gemara in Avodah Zarah and Daf Hei Amud Aleph. Tanu Rabbonin, Mi Yitein V'Hoyo Levovum Zeh Lohem. The Ribbono Shel Olam says, after Matan Torah, when he sees Yisrael has reached such a high level, Mi Yitein, who can ensure that their minds and hearts will retain this level afterwards? How can we preserve it? Amar Lohem Moshe, the Yisrael, Moshe was saying to Yisrael, Kfuye Toivo B'nei Kfuye Toivo. You so-and-sos, you are ungrateful people, the children of ungrateful people. B'shor shomar HaKadosh Baruch Hu L'Yisrael Midi Yitim V'yol V'ovam Zeh Elohim Ayolem Lema Teinato. When Ribbono Shel Olam said, almost pathetically, with his tongue hanging out for the right answer, who can preserve the status? What can we do about preserving the status? I'm Yisrael, at such a wonderful moment, we're so close. What can we do to keep it that way? Says Moshe Rabbeinu, Yisrael should have answered, Ribbono Shel Olam, is it so close? Is it so precious? Why don't you keep it that way? We're in your hands. You are our Father. You keep it. We also find it precious. We also want it to stay that way. You do it. But they didn't. And Moshe Rabbeinu calls them ungrateful as a result of that. But they let the moment pass. And they lose their level. They don't maintain that. Why are they kfuye tova? Kfuye tova, says the Gemara, dichtiv, because it says, v'nafshenu kotso belechem hakeloikel, our posuk. This that they were able to say about the mon, that it was this light food which has no substance, to be able to talk about the mon in that way shows that they're ungrateful. Even though we've understood their complaint in a spiritual sense, but as we've explained, the spiritual sense is fine if that's only striving for more. But if in your striving for more you're prepared to undermine what you've got, there's nothing spiritual about that. That's ingratitude. That's called kfuye toiva. B'nei kfuye toiva, they are the children of ungrateful people. Where do you see that? Dichtiv, as it says, O isho asher nosato imodi, hi nosno li b'na'itzvoicha. When
Adam sinned and ate from the fruit, and the Ribbono Shel Olam comes and says, what's this business? He says, the wife whom you gave me. What did he mean by that?
He meant, Ribbono Shel Olam, you gave me a wife. You're not an ordinary shatchan. You're the Ribbono Shel Olam after all. I expect that before you gave me a wife, you checked that she knew her laws of kashrus and that she was a Yoresh Shemayim. I assume I can go into the dining room and eat whatever she puts down. Do I have to be the Mashgiach as well? When you brought this woman, you created her, and you gave it to me. Do I still have to be the Mashgiach and stick my nose into the pot and ask her where everything comes from?
It's a good taina. That's a very good claim. Why is he hammered? Ha'isho asher nosoto imodi. It's true. What you're saying is, I expected more from her. Fine, but still, the fact that you got her altogether was a gift of the Ribbono Shel Olam. Don't talk down the gift. You don't do that. Take the blame yourself, do what you want, but don't talk down the gift. You've been given something. Don't be ungrateful. So you were let down, you've got a good time, fine. So she didn't perform as she was supposed to have performed, fine, nor did you. Leave it at that. To say to the giver of the gift that there was a fault in the gift, and that's why I did it, even if it's true. You don't say that kind of thing. That's kfuya toiva. Person that gives you a motor car, all of a sudden, out of the blue, you wake up one morning and outside your door there's the most magnificent Rolls Royce, brand new, and there's a knock on the door, and you go to the door and there's a friend of yours who says, this is a gift for you. You say, why, nothing, just accept this as a gift for you, it's yours, I appreciate you, that's it. A few weeks later he invites you to dinner. And you come to dinner, but you're a little bit late. He opens the door, good evening. He says, why are you so late? So, it's your Rolls Royce, broke down, the one you gave me. Don't say that. Even if it's true, you don't say that. So I'm terribly sorry I'm late, something cropped up. That's all. You don't say to him, it was the Rolls Royce he gave you. Even if it's true. Kfuya toiva b'nei kfuya toiva. In both cases, we've got people undermining something which has been given to them, and being given to them at no cost. Why does Moshe Rabbeinu attribute that to their reluctance at answering the Ribbono Shel Olam when he says, "Mi yitein v'hoyo levavam ze lohem"? If only who could ensure that their heart would remain this way? Says Tosis, "Lekach kara'om kafuye tovo." This is why Hashem has called them ungrateful. Sheloi rotsu loimer atote. They didn't want to say, Ribbono Shel Olam, you keep us on this level, you ensure it. Why not? Lefi sheloi yuroitzim lahachazik loy tzeva b'kach. Because that would make them eternally indebted to the Ribbono Shel Olam. And the human being is not willing to accept eternal indebtedness. The Ribbono Shel Olam created us in a way where indebtedness is intolerable to us. That's the whole purpose of creation. That the Ribbono Shel Olam wants us to buy our Olam Haba, to earn our Olam Haba. So he creates us with an intolerance for indebtedness. And he says, right, do you hate indebtedness so much? Fine. Look at this magnificent world to come that I've preserved for you. You don't want to be indebted, go and work for it. And he creates us with this enormous desire not to be indebted. He holds before us incredible reward, and he says, you don't want to be indebted, fine, work for it and you will have earned it, you won't have to be indebted. That's the ultimate of kindness, to enable a person to achieve his maximum potential through his own effort, the ultimate of goodness. That's what the Ribbono Shel Olam gives us, and we take this inability to be indebted and we use it against the Ribbono Shel Olam himself. Because two things happen when a person is unwilling to be indebted. He must do one of two things. He must either repay his debt, or he must deny his debt. He must claim that there is no indebtedness. One of the two. Otherwise he can't live with himself. He's either got to convince himself that he was never lent the money, or he's got to repay it. But to live with the knowledge that he is indebted, a moral human being can't live with that. And therefore, says Tosfos, they were not willing. The Ribbono Shel Olam comes along and is suggesting to them, if you'll only say the word, he says the Ribbono Shel Olam, I can keep you on this level of Kabbalah HaTorah for the rest of eternity.
Imagine what that would have done to the history of the world. If we could have stayed on the level of Kabbalah HaTorah for the rest of eternity until this day. Gratitude built into yourselves from the time of Adam HaRishon. This is inherent in human nature. Just as you said, Lechem Akleikel, just as you referred to this gift of Mom with a derogatory term, so Adam HaRishon implied in a derogatory sense that the gift he was given, and implied to the giver of that gift, that the gift was imperfect and inadequate. Of course she was imperfect, of course she was inadequate. She was a human being just like him. But you don't say that to the giver. That's you don't say. Keep it to yourself. And so it is that we find a child must find imperfections in the parent, because the debt of gratitude to the parent is too heavy to bear, and he can't repay it. So instead he diminishes the parent. The parent isn't so wonderful after all. He did it for his own pleasure, and he did it because he liked having children, and he did it for this and for that. All sorts of reasons why the child can feel a little less guilty about inadequate kibud avay. That's the way he appeases himself. That's the way he satisfies himself that the indebtedness is not so great. A parent to the child has no need to do that. The parent doesn't feel indebted to the child, so he has no need to diminish the stature of his child in his own eyes. There he sees only the good of his child. He can't see the negative. On the contrary, the more somebody else is indebted to you, the more good you find in them. That's another strange thing. If somebody owes you money, you like to think good of them. You like to think they're going to repay. You don't like to think that they're ungrateful. You don't like to think you're going to lose your money. If you've invested money in a company, you like to think the company is good. It's very hard to pass a cold and critical opinion about a company. We don't tolerate criticism that easily of the things we've done, of the things we've built, of the things we've created. We like to believe they're good, and it's quite hard to convince us otherwise. And so we have a very interesting principle that emerges from all this. The more one takes, the more one must find fault with the source of that which one is taking. The more one gives, the less one must find fault with the recipient of the person of that to which one is giving. And that's why the key in marriage is mutual giving. If one gives a lot to one's wife, one will find less fault with her. If she gives a lot to her husband, she will find less fault with him. When the husband and wife are in a complaining mood, or when the husband or wife are in a complaining mood, you can know with absolute certainty that there's no giving, that there's no investment in one another. They're busy taking from one another, and the more they take from each other, the more resentful they get at the bondage that creates, at the degree of indebtedness that creates, from which they feel they'll never be able to escape. But if one is investing, if I've given more than I've taken, then I don't become bound. Then I don't become indebted. If I'm giving, then I'm the balabos. If I'm the balabos, I see only the good. I don't see the negative.